Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on Air. On this week's show, we address some common injuries to the upper extremities.
Frequently, the tendons, which are the parts of the body that connect the actual muscle fibers to the bones themselves, become torn or worn thin and irritated, and that is usually what's called rotator cuff pathology or problems.
Plus, inflammation of the eye and how to treat it.
Most of my patients have something in the category of an autoimmune disease, such as lupus or rheumatoid arthritis.
And that awful problem we know as migraine headaches. We'll learn why we get them and what to do about them.
I usually like to think as triggers, as things that push you closer to that threshold. People with migraine, however, will have a much lower threshold.
All that and a piece from our healing muse, and that's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On this week's show, we explore inflammatory diseases of the eye and how to protect oneself against ocular injuries. Plus, all about migraines, that common yet often debilitating problem. But first, injuries of the hand, wrist, and fingers, and how best to treat them. Well, our wrists, hands, and fingers are intricate collections of muscles and joints that we put to use in hundreds of ways every day. But we often never fully realize or appreciate how much we use them until we've suffered an injury or a painful condition in that area. Here to discuss the most common injuries to our upper extremities and how to treat them is Dr. Joshua Pletka, Assistant Professor of Orthopedic Surgery at Upstate Medical University and Chief of Orthopedics at Upstate's Community Campus. He specializes in hand and upper extremity injuries. Welcome, Dr. Pletka. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start by just helping us understand a little bit more. When we say upper extremities, to you as a physician, as an orthopedist, what do you mean?
Well, usually upper extremity denotes problems that occur from the fingertips all the way up to the shoulder. That includes the collarbone and the shoulder blade bone called the scapula.
Okay, that's pretty clear. So basically, within that world, I thought we'd go through some of the common injuries and or conditions that you might see. So I thought I'd start with, to me, what seems the most obvious, and that is some kind of a traumatic injury like a fracture.
Absolutely. So a fracture, which is a medical term, is commonly known as a break or a broken bone. And so right now with the snow and the ice and the slush outside, a lot of people are slipping and falling. There are car accidents that are occurring, people using snow blowers and snowmobiles. And as a result of these activities, they frequently suffer traumatic injuries that result in a broken bone. And so a fracture is a break of one of the bones of any part of the body, but with regards to the upper extremity, from the fingertips all the way up to the shoulder.
And we'll talk a little bit about treatment and what that all means, but obviously that seems like, to me, one of the more obvious things that occurs in that part of the body.
It is a very common injury.
How about things like dislocations of the joints? Is that something you see? Is that part of your...
Yes, so dislocations of the joints, which are the interconnections between the bones, like the elbow or the wrist or the parts of the fingers that bend, those occur much more commonly as a result of sports injuries, playing basketball, while we treat those, they are not as frequent as fractures because a lot of force needs to be applied to get a bone to dislocate rather than break.
How about things like rotator cuff? That's something I've heard about that my whole life. People are always complaining about this part of their body. That's within this world of upper extremity. Am I correct?
It is.
And people are often complaining about either an injury or a tear. Tell us about the rotator cuff and what seems to happen with it. First of all, what is it?
So the rotator cuff is part of the shoulder, and it is a series of four muscles that are deep within the shoulder that normally you can't feel or see from the outside. And their job is to stabilize the ball of the ball and socket joint of the shoulder and keep it located in its proper position while your arm goes through a range of motion. Now, as a function of aging, wear and tear, activity, and the environment, you can sustain injuries or degenerative problems that occur to that part of the body. Frequently, the tendons, which are the parts of the body that connect the actual muscle fibers to the bones themselves, become torn or worn thin and irritated, and that is usually what's called rotator cuff pathology or problems.
And those usually need to be treated with some kind of surgical intervention, or not always?
Not always. So many rotator cuff problems can be treated conservatively with rest, activity modification, physical therapy, some anti-inflammatory medications, and occasionally corticosteroid injections or steroid injections in the area of the shoulder.
How about another thing that I think of also that's I hear very commonly talked about as an injury, but also something that happens over time is carpal tunnel. People talk about that. Help us understand what that is, what part of the body it affects, and you know how does it occur?
So carpal tunnel is a very common condition, and what it is one of the nerves that controls the feeling in the tips of your thumb, your index finger, and your middle finger is compressed. But it's compressed in the area between the wrist and the base of the hand. And it occurs as a function of many different things. Most commonly, it's just the way that people are designed. And over time, the space that this nerve lives in shrinks. And as it shrinks, it puts pressure on the nerve. And I compare it to having a shirt that's too tight around your neck. And you can imagine that with that sort of situation, you're
Gasping for air.
And that's when the nerve is gasping for air, it talks by tingling, burning, and feeling numb in those three fingers, the thumb, the index, and the middle finger.
And generally, is the optimum treatment for something like carpal tunnel usually surgical?
Many times with carpal tunnel, as it progresses to become a constant problem or a severe or moderately severe problem, surgery becomes one of the only ways to create more space for this nerve. The initial treatments, though, are non-operative and consist of bracing and activity modification that keep the wrist in a better position to prevent having as much pressure as there could be on the nerve.
When some of these things I've mentioned already, do most of these occur in adults, or do you also see any of these things like we talked? Well, fractures, of course, will affect children as well. But things like joint dislocations, rotator cuff, or carpal tunnel, do those affect children?
So, yes and no. As you said, fractures are things that very commonly occur in children. And the thing that is unique about children is because they are growing, there are parts of their bones that are not fully developed. And so many times when they suffer an injury, it's to an area of their bone called the growth plate, which is the part of the body that contributes length to the bones and is why people get taller and get longer hands and arms. And this is the weak spot in children. When you're an adult, that part of the body goes away or burns itself out, and that's when you stop growing. The other injuries that you mentioned, like carpal tunnel and rotator cuff problems, are things that are very uncommon in children. It's not never, but it's extremely rare to have disorders that are associated mostly with aging occurring in younger people.
What are the consequences, though, for example, of a young child sustaining something like a fracture or a joint dislocation? I mean, are there long-term consequences after successful treatment?
So frequently, no. And there are always instances where bad things happen and children end up with permanent deformities or limitations as a result of an injury. Some of these things cannot be avoided. Sometimes they can. As doctors, we try and shepherd the body through its healing process and line things up and realign the bones to enhance and optimize the outcome, but we can't control the innate healing of a person's body to any real degree. And so sometimes bad things can occur.
You know, one other thing that I hear about all the time is this thing called trigger finger. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that's something you deal with all the time. Tell us what that is and what does it mean?
So trigger finger is a very common condition. It obviously affects the fingers. And what happens is the tendons, which are the ropes that connect the forearm muscles to the fingertips and helps them bend as you bend your fingers down into a fist, they run through a series of little channels. And I liken it to a truck going through a tunnel. Your tendon is the truck and the tunnel is the channel that it runs through. And for reasons that are difficult to explain, the tunnel becomes thickened, and then as the truck goes back and forth through it, every time you open and close your hand, eventually the roof of the truck starts to rub on the tunnel itself, and then it starts to catch and thicken, and then it starts to cause a sensation of actually triggering. Your finger feels like it's sort of catching and then unlocking, sort of like the trigger of a pistol.
And is that something that needs, again, surgical intervention, or can that be treated in a variety of ways?
Most of the times, if trigger fingers are not painful or bothersome, people live with them. But when they become aggravating or limiting or painful to a degree that patients can't tolerate, we usually treat those with injections. And 70 to 80% of the time, a single injection will make the problem go away for a long time.
And the injections would be something like a corticosteroid, which would allow the shrinkage or the shrinkage of the problem or the expansion of
the
space?
That's right. So
or...
the steroid medicines are anti-inflammatories, and they shrink the swollen or irritated tissue, or in the case of the tunnel, it enlarges the tunnel slightly and allows the tendon to glide back and forth through it without catching.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, along with orthopedic surgeon Dr. Joshua Pletka. We're talking about conditions and injuries involving the upper extremities and what can be done about them. Just a couple more, and then I want to ask you a little bit more about treatment. What about when people have certain kinds of congenital problems? How frequently do you see that? And do you see that obviously would be in children? What are the kinds of things you see there?
So the most common congenital conditions, which are obviously conditions that children are born with, and so many times now with advanced imaging in the prenatal period before the birth of a child, these things can be identified. But most commonly, it's an extra digit, an extra small finger,
really?
An extra thumb, or that the fingers, the web space between the fingers never fully developed and the fingers are stuck together. It's called a syndactyly.
Wow, and those obviously would require some surgical intervention.
So those do require surgery, but usually it's not immediate, and it's not done while the child is newly born or in the first 6 months. But after that, as they're a little bit bigger, they can be treated, but usually it is surgical treatment.
So generally, and this was just a quick overview of the kinds of things you see. I mean, I'm sure there are so many, many, many more things that you, address in your practice. Just generally, how do you go through a diagnostic process in general, overview?
So the first thing that we do with every patient that comes in is we get a history. So we take the information from the patient about the event, how long the condition has been present, whether it was traumatic or not traumatic, whether it came on suddenly or gradually, whether they remember it being associated with any particular event or process. And after that, we go through a physical exam where we actually examine, touch the patient, move the parts of the body, palpate, and look for swelling, redness, crunching, or what's called crepitus. And after we've done that, we usually do supplemental imaging. And most commonly, the imaging test that we use is an X-ray. We usually don't need to get CT scans or MRIs or fancier things. An X-ray combined with the physical exam and the history usually suffices to make 95% of the diagnoses.
Of the two others that you mentioned, like the CT and the MRI, when might you use them and how might they be more helpful?
Well, so those advanced imaging tests, like a CAT scan or a CT scan, is basically a very fancy X-ray. And what it does is it lets you appreciate the details of the bones much better. So situations where that can be helpful are, one, in the setting of a bad fracture that is near a joint, where it's critical to have an appreciation of the different broken pieces and not always able to be achieved through looking at a plain X-ray. Sometimes things are superimposed. So the CT scan lets you dive in a little bit deeper and get an appreciation of exactly what's going on.
When, if ever, would you use an MRI or not?
So we use MRIs when we're looking for soft tissue problems. The MRI is not usually a great test for evaluating the bones. A CAT scan is much better. But an MRI is a helpful test when we're looking for things that we can't see on an X-ray, that we can't feel, but that we're suspicious are hiding underneath. And usually an MRI is not as much of a diagnostic test as it is a confirmatory test. We have a suspicion and we use the MRI to confirm.
So obviously the types of treatment that you choose will vary with the particular problem, and we've just done a whole laundry list of the kinds of problems you see. But let me give you an example. So for example, how do you determine the treatment options, let's say for a fracture, Or a sprain or a strain? When would surgery be necessary versus splinting or casts? And then when might you do something like physical therapy?
Well, so depending on the severity of an injury, the fractures will dictate the treatment usually for us. And so fractures that are well aligned, where the bones have not really shifted out of position, many times can be treated non-operatively. When the bones are out of alignment, meaning they're crooked, they're bent, they're not lined upright, sometimes if we can't remedy that without surgery, then we have to go in and realign the bones surgically. Strains and sprains frequently are treated non-operatively. Situations where strains might be treated operatively are in situations like where you rupture a tendon or tear a tendon, like an Achilles tendon rupture, or a ligament injury in the knee, like an ACL tear. That's a sprain of a very high grade, and frequently those require surgery as well. Physical therapy is an integral part of all of our treatments, and it's usually done in conjunction with surgery, but many times it's done to prevent surgery.
Now, I understand that you are opening a new clinic right now to actually address all of these kinds of issues and to improve accessibility to people, because obviously some of these things are, you know, frank injuries due to trauma. They need immediate care. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, so we have always been very big proponents of easy accessibility for patients and for their referring doctors. And so we started on February 1st with what's called a hand walk-in clinic. And it applies to all patients with injuries of the upper extremity, as we've discussed, from the fingertips to the shoulders. And it basically allows people who sustain an injury either late in the evening or early in the morning, who either go and see their doctor or don't even go and see their doctor, to walk right into our clinic in the afternoon between the hours of 3 and 4:30, and they can be seen without an appointment on an urgent basis. It's not meant for chronic conditions that have been present for months, but if you slip and fall and you think you might have injured something badly or you just are not sure, it's an easy way to get definitive answers about your problem and treatment for them.
And how would one find out about that?
So the best way to go about finding out about it is our website. And our website is www.upstateorthopedics.com.
Very good. Thank you so much. My guest has been Dr. Joshua Pletka. He's Assistant Professor of Orthopedic Surgery at Upstate Medical University and the Chief of Orthopedics at Upstate's Community Campus. He specializes in the hand and upper extremity injuries. Next, inflammatory diseases of the eye. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Inflammation of the eye is quite common and can affect all parts of the eye, both the outside and the inside. And many of the diseases that are caused by inflammation are preventable and treatable, but others can be quite serious and even lead to blindness. Here with more on all of this is Dr. Robert Swan. He's Assistant Professor of Ophthalmology at Upstate Medical University, and he's the Director of the Uveitis Service. Welcome, Dr. Swan. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
So uveitis, or inflammation of the eye, is quite common. But what exactly is uveitis?
Uveitis is a word that the Latin, it refers to an inner lining of the eye, but ultimately it's used to mean inflammation of the eye. It means that an eye on the inside is inflamed. And because we can look into an eye, you can see the white blood cells floating around. People will have certain symptoms, but when you put it all together, you can see that this is an eye that's inflamed.
But the idea that it has it's an inflammatory process, does this encompass a number of diseases, or is it a disease? In other words, is the term uveitis really describing the symptom of inflammation?
Sure. It's a very big catch-all term. Mm-hmm. My textbook is called uveitis, and in that textbook there are 60 chapters, each with a separate cause.
Okay.
There are infectious causes, there are inflammatory causes, and there are sort of other call them each in their own unique categories, you know, sometimes mechanical causes or things. It's a very broad, very, very broad subject.
So I want to get to some of those causes in just a minute in a little more detail, but how common is it then? I mean, in your practice, how common is it to see someone with this kind of inflammation?
It's common, but not very common. It's when I was in general practice, I had a few people. Of people in general, they would have it uncommonly. They would have it, you know, it might their eye would be inflamed once and then maybe not again for years. But the ones you get to know are the ones that I became interested in and did a fellowship in. These are the ones that are in my office every 2 or 3 months.
So there are chronic cases.
Yes. And those are the ones that are really the focus of my practice. And in terms of how common it is in the community, I have people coming from Ithaca, from Binghamton, from Rochester, and it keeps me busy.
So in that sense, there's a real need.
Yes.
So what are the kinds of problems we just alluded to, you know, what causes it, this general inflammation? It can be caused by a number of underlying conditions.
Correct.
Help us understand what are the kinds of things that can lead to uveitis.
Sure. In the infectious category is more and more uncommon in the United States. In the developing world, there's a lot of infections that get into eyes, and they, you know, it's very difficult to even find the people, let alone treat them.
Is that because of poor sanitation, perhaps, or lack of education?
It can be a number of things. In, for example, India, tuberculosis is much more common, and tuberculosis can really affect an eye. But most of the infections are rare. They don't lead to chronic things. It's the type of thing where, for example, I have somebody who had a thorn puncture his eye and sit there for a couple of days, and there was a fungal something that was growing, and we took care of it. But usually these stories have a beginning. Most of my patients have something in the category of an autoimmune disease. They may have something that has a distinct label, such as lupus or rheumatoid arthritis, sarcoidosis. There's a very large list. Pretty much everything you see advertised on television for things like Humira, that they talk about psoriatic arthritis or ankylosing spondylitis.
So all of those kinds of autoimmune diseases where the body basically attacks itself, so to speak, can cause inflammation within the eye.
Right. And it doesn't always make sense as to why. For example, people with Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, which is a clear intestinal inflammation, can often have eye findings. And that's really where my practice specializes in, is in those patients.
So is it basically so it's not limited or in terms of the age range? I mean, you can see uveitis or some inflammation of the eye even in children?
We have. The ages seem to be different. Things occur at different ages. Children tend to have the worst type of it. And the reason is that it tends to be associated with arthritis, but their eyes look white. They look normal. They're completely, I mean, without an eye doctor really looking for it, you wouldn't see it. But it just smolders, like a very slow fire in the walls. And it that slow burn over a very long period of time can cause all sorts of problems that when it's finally found, you're starting with tissue that's been severely damaged.
But now I want to talk a little bit about really how that process occurs. But what you're alluding to is, you're not just talking about a run-of-the-mill child. You're talking about someone with an underlying, generally with an underlying autoimmune problem like juvenile arthritis, juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, that type of thing.
For the most part. There are some children that have inflammation. We watch them because perhaps they're going to. Some children with inflammation develop the arthritis later. That's the majority of children's inflammation. I've got a couple children that we frankly don't know why. But they're few and far between. Usually I work with the pediatric rheumatologists on this.
So what exactly causes, as you were alluding to, the damage to the eye? You were saying something like inflammation smoldering in the eye or any, I mean, how long does it take for there to be actual damage to the eye? And to what degree does it impact the eye? In other words, can you end up blind?
It's a good question. It depends on the person. It depends on the inflammation. The best analogy for this is a fire. And so if it's a slow burn, if it's a smoldering something, it could take a while. But some people, they burn really hot. And they know who they are. They come right in and see me. Their eyes are, you know, they're red. They're uncomfortable. They're incredibly inflamed. We do everything we can to get it out. And so if somebody is having episodes like that every 2 or 3 months, it doesn't take that long to start showing damage. whereas other people hopefully would never have a problem if we can get it under control quickly.
So the effect of the inflammation is cumulative, in other words,
yes,
over time, and it can lead to things like glaucoma, swelling, cataracts, all of that?
All of those things. An eye is a very fragile, it's amazing how durable it is. As an eye doctor, it's one of those amazing things where you appreciate just how strong it is and both how fragile it is. I think there's other things like that that we all can think of. And so, you know, I see somebody who's over 100 years old and their eye is great and they're seeing great. And you say, how can a tissue last and be this good this long, you know, in terms of the clarity and the optics? But once it's jarred, once it's disturbed, once it's injured, these things can become a problem. And it can be hard to fix it once that snowball starts going down the hill.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here along with Dr. Robert Swan. We're talking about uveitis and other inflammatory diseases of the eye. So the treatment of the inflammation mm-hmm. is key here.
Yes.
So exactly what is the notion here? The focus is to basically, as you say, put the fire out.
Right. The fellowship that I worked with, a world expert in Boston, and he has a stone that's carved with whatever it takes. In general, that's corticosteroids. And we can put them either with an eye drop. Some people are on pills. We inject steroids around the eye. They make commercially available steroids that are slow release that you surgically put into the eye. They all are good. They all work. But the problem with steroids in people that have it chronically is that they have a cumulative problem. And so a lot of people that are on steroids cumulatively will get the same cataract and glaucoma that they would have gotten without anything.
So the treatment sometimes can be as damaging as the actual event.
If the corticosteroids are the only treatment. What the eye doctors that dealt with people with chronic, again, people with acute uveitis, it happens every so often. The steroid drops put it out, and that's usually enough. But people that are on them, you know, some people, you put them on steroids and they're fine, but you can't take them away. So if they're 25, what's your long-term goal? What's the end point? What we've learned from the rheumatologists is that there's other therapies. The rheumatologists have been treating autoimmune diseases, and they've understood the problem with chronic steroids much better than we have as ophthalmologists because they see it every day. And so a lot of my chronic medicines are the same things that people are using to treat sarcoidosis or lupus or other things in that nature. They're steroid-sparing agents.
So give me an example of what one of those might be.
Maybe the best example is methotrexate, which we've been using in rheumatology and in ophthalmology now for about 50 years. It's very well known, and that's if we have a child that requires chronic steroids, we'll often start with that one because as much as we don't want to put our children on anything, if you're going to have to choose something, you want something that's been around a long time, something that you know exactly how it works, what it does, what it doesn't do, what to look for, what not to. And that seems to be our most common. Other things in that class, mycophenolate, azathioprine, when that doesn't work, we use cyclosporin. And if that doesn't work, we're starting to go more towards the biologics, which are the Humira and Remicade and a lot of the things you see professional golfers
advertising
on the radio.
But the point here is that you're attempting to actually treat the underlying autoimmune
Correct.
Problem as well, and hopefully that while by treating that, the inflammation in general will die down throughout the body.
Correct.
And then the eye will also be spared
That's
in
true.
That process.
So if you have somebody with Crohn's disease who's on a certain treatment and their eyes are still active, that treatment, even if their intestines are good, should be increased. You know, we do what we need. We do whatever it takes.
What are the symptoms when we're talking about uveitis or we're talking about this kind of inflammation? You've alluded to what can happen
mm-hmm.
and that the inflammation can really wreak havoc. But what exactly, how would someone know that they had uveitis?
For the most part, for starting with younger people, children don't have any symptoms. But the ones with arthritis are referred to us for screening, and we watch them every 3 months as they grow up. Adults,
so that's just preventative.
Correct, because they're the ones that it will look perfectly normal. Most people with uveitis, once they reach, say, 16, 20, 30, their eye will be red. It will be uncomfortable. It will be the kind of thing that somebody who doesn't normally go to an emergency room would go for. They would say, something's not right here. I'm light sensitive. That's the major...
Is there pain?
It's uncomfortable, but it's often light-induced uncomfort.
So the light is bothersome.
Well, their muscles are inside of your eye, are inflamed, and when the light makes them constrict your pupil, it just makes it that much more. So these people are hiding in a dark room thinking there's something wrong.
How about vision? Is your vision blurred?
For the most part, they tend to be blurry. Most inflamed eyes are blurry. Some of my patients with deeper inflammation of the retina or the vitreous or the optic nerve, kind of not in the front of the eye, will often have a haze. And they'll be the first ones to say I have a lot of floaters. And everybody has a couple floaters, but these people kind of know where there's too many to count. And they know what's coming. And so that can be a major symptom.
So how do you actually detect it? I mean, what's the diagnostic process? What do you use to determine that someone has uveitis?
For the most part, we use the slit lamp is the binocular-mounted light source that we use in the eye when you get an eye exam. I can usually see the inflammation. I can look in there and see the white blood cells moving around. But we have a lot of specialized testing. We do angiograms where we can see if vessels are inflamed or the nerve is inflamed, and the dyes will stick to things. And you'll have patterns, which can sometimes lead you to other diagnoses that you weren't necessarily thinking about initially.
So the key here is you can do a definitive diagnosis. You have clear symptoms much of the time. Mm-hmm. And with children, as you mentioned, it's really often a case of it being secondary or a consequence of more of an autoimmune disease that they have, and that's already been diagnosed. But in terms of treatments, you just said you gave us kind of a full range of mm-hmm. what the kinds of treatments are. How successful are they, and what is the long-term outcome for these people?
Well, we start with whatever it takes. The vast majority of people don't need anything other than steroid drops once in a while. Some people, when they flare, they need pills, they need something stronger.
But in the way of steroids.
Correct. For the smaller subset that's chronic that I deal with, most of them do very well. Our success rate with methotrexate and things like that are about 70%. Success being defined as both it works and it's not causing any side effects that are worth stopping it for. If it is causing a side effect, we change it. We find something else that works.
So in the long run, mm-hmm. if somebody has an autoimmune disease and has developed uveitis, generally they have a positive outcome.
For the most part, it depends on if you can catch it early. For people who are, you need to have an idea of where you're going. I've had patients come to me where they're getting a steroid injection every month for the last 5 years, and you say, well, what was the plan for the next 5 years? But for the most part, if we can stop it, then they have a very good, they're just as fine as everybody else. You'd never even know that they had a problem.
Oh, that's very hopeful. And the little bit of time we have left, very mm-hmm. quickly. Our eyes are so sensitive. What do you recommend for people as far as protecting them from injury? Just real brief.
The polycarbonate safety glasses, and not just at work, but when you're doing things at home. Anything that you're doing metal on metal, hammering, nails, anything, you want to be wearing eye protection.
That's crucial.
Every day.
Thank you so much. My guest has been Dr. Robert Swan. He's assistant professor of ophthalmology at Upstate and the director of the Uveitis Service. Next up, all about migraines and what can help. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air, Linda Cohen along with you. In the United States, more than 37 million people suffer from migraines. Some migraine studies estimate that 13% of adults have migraines, and 2 to 3 million migraine sufferers are chronic, causing moderate to severe disability. We'll hear with more on this is Dr. Luis Mejico, professor of neurology and ophthalmology at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Mejico. Thanks for coming in.
Glad to be here.
So let's begin by helping our listeners understand, what do we mean when we say migraine? What is a migraine?
So migraine is a very specific form of headache, although interesting, sometimes headache is not a part of it, but we can get to that later, so it's not too confusing. But migraine is a primary headache disorder. In other words, it's a disorder of the brain that is caused by a specific biology that many times we inherit from our parents, and that's why it runs in family as a very prevalent condition. But clearly, is a disease that has to be tackled by itself. So in other words, trying to figure out what is the cause of migraine sometimes is not useful.
But what is actually happening in the brain to cause a migraine, and how is that different from other headaches?
So in migraine, we have studied its biology, and we understand it as several steps that are happening in the brain. We haven't figured out all the pieces of the puzzle, but clearly there is a component where, for example, the pain originates from the surface of the brain. The surface of the brain, as many people know, is called meninges, and in the meninges we have this system that is where we have blood vessels and we have specific neurons, and it's called the trigeminal vascular system, and that's where a lot of the migraine pain comes from. But then there's central networks. There's networks that go inside the brain, and there's circuits, and it gets fairly complicated. But clearly, you can view it as a cascade of events and eventually as a chemical storm in the brain. That's how I think of it.
So is there actually a swelling or an enlargement of the vessels during that time that create the symptoms?
So the blood vessels in the surface of the brain, not within the brain, vasodilate.
They get bigger.
They get bigger. And then there's release of these chemical substances that irritate the nerve endings on the surface of the brain. And that's why when people have a migraine, it's painful to walk, it's painful to cough, to laugh, to strain, because there is some irritation that is happening on the surface of the brain.
So how is it different? I mean, when we say headache in general, how is this different? I mean, a typical quote-unquote tension headache.
Yeah, so tension-type headache is the most common form of headache. It's what people refer to as common headaches. And those are headaches that usually are not disabling. People can continue to function. There's little associated symptoms beyond the headache. Migraine is different. Migraine headache tends to be described as throbbing, moderate to severe. It may be on one side of the head or both sides of the head. It gets worse with movement. It gets better with rest. And it's associated with other symptoms. People get sensitive to light, to sound. They may feel nauseous. They may even vomit. Sometimes there are other associated symptoms such as dizziness and malaise and decreased appetite. The duration of the headache is defined as a headache that lasts for several hours. And there's specific criteria for that. But let's just say that it's a headache that lasts for several hours. Some people have their headache is preceded by other symptoms. The more
they
common,
call the aura.
It's called the aura, exactly. And these are focal neurological symptoms. The most common is the visual aura, where people will see somewhere in their visual field this area that it tends to be shimmering, tends to be, it expands in size, and it lasts for a few minutes, and then it's followed by the headache. Mm-hmm. Other symptoms that may precede headache symptoms is numbness or tingling in various parts of the body. And then there's a recovery phase after the migraine headache is over, where the person may feel tired or drowsy or moody. There are certainly a sort of a post-headache phase. So the entire migraine is preceded by symptoms, then it's followed by headache, and then it's followed by even other more pervasive symptoms.
So who is most at risk for this? What are our typical migraine sufferers looking like?
So migraine sufferers tend to be women. The ratio of women to men is 3-1. They tend to be young adults. Migraines happen during the years of most productive productivity. However, it may happen in children. It may happen in the elderly as well. But it tends to be more common in young adults.
So it can usually occur lifelong.
Yes, I mean, migraine certainly can transform itself over the years, sometimes presenting in childhood with symptoms that don't even have headaches. There are very specific syndromes that are most interesting. For example, there's a syndrome where children will have spells of vomiting, and that's all what they have. They just vomit. There are also spells where children may have dizziness and they see the room spinning and without headache. Then when they're teenagers, maybe they develop a more classical headache syndrome. And then and then when they're older, they may get less headaches but more visual aura, for example.
So how do you clinically actually diagnose this? Is it just from the symptomatology?
It's just from the symptomatology, and also the feature that these are episodes that repeat over time. So it's difficult sometimes to make the diagnosis based on only one or two or two episodes. But if the person gives a clear history of previous similar episodes, then the diagnosis of migraine is more certain. And then, of course, it's based on a full evaluation where we do physical exam, we look at other contributing factors. There's a whole medical evaluation that goes on.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with neurologist Dr. Luis Mejico. We're talking about migraines. People often talk about this thing called triggers, you know, because apparently there are things that will cause a migraine to occur. Many people have that experience. Tell us what they are, or what are the common ones, and, you know, how significant are they?
Right, so it is thought that we all have a threshold beyond which we can induce a migraine headache, a migraine-like headache, even on somebody who's never had a headache.
Really?
People with migraine, however, will have a much lower threshold. So I usually like to think as triggers, as things that push you closer to that threshold. So it tends to be multifactorial. So there's a weather storm that is coming, and then I am stressed because of this and that, and I didn't sleep well last night, and then I had a glass of wine. And that all this accumulation of triggers push me over that threshold. Other people, however, may have very, very specific triggers that will throw them over that edge, over the threshold, very rapidly. And it is not known what percentage of people is like that, but people will, some people will tell you, if I have a glass of red wine, of white wine, something very specific.
I'm one of those people.
Okay. Yes. And if you identify that, then you know to stay away from it.
Exactly.
It's more difficult for the person who has multifactorial elements. You cannot control the weather unless you move to somewhere else.
Right.
But, you know, you may be able to control that glass of alcohol, for example.
Right. So it's important to know those
triggers
for the individual. That actually leads me into this whole concept of treatment, or what you can do about it, because obviously it can be a very disabling condition, especially for some people who have them chronically, regularly, etc. Because it's as a migraine sufferer myself, I will say they're painful, quite painful. So I thought we'd start with kind of behavioral things that the patient themselves can do. What are the kinds of things you recommend?
Exactly, and those are very, very important points. Migraine can be extremely disabling, and severe form of migraines have been, considered, for example, by the World Health Organization as being as severe as being quadriplegic. So spinal cord injuries has been a comparison. Thank God not everybody will have severe migraines, but behavioral treatment is extremely important. It's understanding the relationship between triggers and your migraine headaches. Is also understanding where you are in relationship to that threshold. So if you are having a rough week, that may be the time again to try to control your environment better. When it comes to behavioral treatment for migraine, it's very important the word regular. You want to have regular meals at regular times, regular exercise, regular sleep, and regular is like the key word here, which is difficult sometimes. We all have busy lives, we all have things to do, and we may skip a meal and we get a headache.
Or lose sleep or whatever for any number of reasons.
Absolutely.
Right. So that's key. So that's actually empowering the patient to at least have some things they can do. So then how about preventive treatment? Because that's of late become much more well understood, I think, we've had the idea of treating symptoms, which I will get to in a minute in terms of medications and what have you, but there are preventive treatments now that are more available for people, especially those who suffer regular migraine headaches.
That's right, and that's the main criteria, is when people are having migraine headaches often, and arbitrarily we have drawn the line, people that have more than three or four headaches a month that are disabling, then those people certainly qualify for preventive treatment. Preventive treatment, we are talking about medications, taking something on a daily basis. And the main purpose of the preventive medicine is to make the headaches less frequent, less severe, and lasting less.
So what kinds of medications are most effective, been shown to be most effective?
Right, so we borrow medications primarily from other family of drugs. We borrow medication from anti-seizure family. We borrow medications from anti-blood pressure family, and also antidepressants. Those are the main three groups. Then we have a miscellaneous group that also include even over-the-counter agent. There's some minerals, some vitamins, some herbal supplements that have been shown to have some effect on prevention of migraine headaches.
What have you seen to be most effective in terms of medications in your own experience clinically?
So probably the most effective oral medication that we have for prevention of migraine is a drug called topiramate. And topiramate is a medication from the anti-epilepsy group, anti-seizure family. We also have medications that are antidepressants. There's an older family of medication that's called the tricyclic antidepressants that we sometimes use. Now, a very important point about this preventive medicine is that we use low doses. We always start with extremely low doses. So we are not aiming at doses that are used for epilepsy or for hypertension. Always low doses first.
Okay, and then you kind of, it's going to be on a case-by-case basis. It's a little trial and error with the individual patient.
Absolutely.
All right, quickly, in the very little time we have left, what's the most effective treatment for the actual painful symptoms?
So, moderate range migraine can be treated with over-the-counter pain medications, such as ibuprofen, and there's some literature behind those. However, severe migraine headaches are best treated with specific migraine killers, as I call them, instead of painkillers, migraine killers. And we are talking about a family of drugs called triptans, T-R-I-P-T-A-N, triptans. And there's several forms available. And again, there's not one that is better than another one, but they have some specific differences between them and we choose depending on the circumstances.
So do you recommend people come to a neurologist when they have a debilitating issue with migraines?
Well, I believe that care should start with their family practitioner. The general practitioner many times can solve a problem such as migraine. And that person has the best judgment to refer to a neurologist
when when it's necessary.
Exactly.
This has been incredibly enlightening. And as a migraine sufferer, I thank you for it. Very good information. Thank you so much. My guest has been Dr. Luis Mejico, Professor of Neurology and Ophthalmology at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. When medical students start their third year, they step onto the floors of the hospital to begin their rotations through various departments and specialties. They take their intense book learning from the first 2 years and try to apply this knowledge to the patients they will meet under the careful eyes of their attendings and residents. But the question they have, can they care for patients even when there is no cure for them? Alyssa Anderson, a fourth-year medical student, describes one of her first experiences in her essay, Finding Our Routine. I would like to read a short excerpt. You are my first admission on my medicine rotation. I walk into the room and notice how small you look under your giant fluffy hat. You are strong, stoic, and a little defensive when we first meet. You are determined to get the fluid drained from your abdomen, control your pain, and get home. You are slightly annoyed, but mostly patient, as I fumble through the interview, asking questions about and tracing the ups and downs of your year. The past year has been mostly downs. You are frustrated as you express just how difficult the past few weeks have been. You are drained as you realize you haven't eaten in days. That's the first time I see your tears. You are 53, with ovarian and breast cancer, both diagnosed last winter. Since then, you've done rounds of chemotherapy, had a surgery that took too long to heal, and tried more chemotherapy. You're a professor at a local college. You enjoy teaching psychology and philosophy. You've maintained two classes throughout your illness, and you feel guilty that you had to miss last week's. You have two sons that live with you. They are your pride. They know you're sick, but you haven't told them how serious your illness is, and you suspect that they're unaware. You were healthy and active before the diagnosis, and you can't understand how this happened to you. Just last week, you started a new chemotherapy drug, and since then, you've been so nauseous that you can't eat without vomiting. The interventional radiologist says there is nothing they can do to make you more comfortable. The attending leaves the room, and you just look at me with despair. I am supposed to be continuing on rounds, but I quickly decide that being here with you in this moment is more important. After much prodding, we convince the radiologist to try to drain something from your abdomen for your comfort. They pull out 2 liters of fluid. You barely feel the difference. You're feeling the weight of the situation, and I'm offering the only things I can think of to distract both of us. Can I get you more water, more pain meds, more pillows? The distraction doesn't work. I don't offer the thing that we both know you need, but no one can give you. Even unspoken, the reality of your situation hangs like an ugly intruder in the room, and the atmosphere is solemn when I leave for the night.
Thank you for joining us for HealthLink On Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we get an update on the heroin epidemic in this country, plus the importance of colon cancer screening to prevent this deadly disease, and how concierge medicine is taking us back to the future. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on iTunes. Just search for HealthLink On Air. That's all one word. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, look for us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks so much for listening.